Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio as we get set for another edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. Dennis Rodkin will be here a little bit later from Crane Chicago Business. He writes about Wall Street. What's the ghost story on the southwest side? Is it Bloody Mary, ghost, the Hitchhiking Mary? Anyway, the Willowbrook Ballroom it burned a few years ago, but they're going to redevelop it now. And so we'll see if they pay homage to the ghost story when they do that. We'll talk to Dennis in the second half hour. Bill Geiger will be here to kick around retirement as well. But we always start on Thursdays, if we're lucky anyway, with Ian Schur from CNET.com. And he joins us on the phone line now. Ian, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm excited. I'm not excited. I'm very curious about this story that Laura, is it Hautala, wrote about what the new governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is proposing, or what they're talking about when it comes to, I think of in Alaska, right? The citizens of Alaska get a rebate when the oil industry is especially good. Newsom is talking almost like a rebate or being paid for computer users to have their private information used or their personal information used. I can't quite wrap my arms around that. Explain it for me.
Well, you've made a really good analogy. This idea that we all create value for Facebook, right? Facebook basically wouldn't exist if we weren't using it. And the same is true for Twitter and all these other things. They don't create value on their own. They're not mining for gold or digging for oil or building houses. They are taking the data we give them and then showing it to giving advertisers access to us and using all of that to show us kind of the best ads they can and make money. And what Gavin Newsom, the new governor of California and former mayor of San Francisco, has said is that, look, we really should start charging some sort of a tax or giving people who are on these platforms a dividend or a portion of the profits that Facebook is making. And it's a really interesting idea. It's very out there. We don't have any details of the bill yet, we don't know all of what he's thinking.
But there is actually a bill being written, right? They are working on some. So my thought when I read this was, well, I get Facebook for free, or I get Twitter for free, and part of my fare to use Facebook is that they have access, or I sign off access to this information. I thought that we had already made that transaction.
Well, and I think that transaction made sense when Facebook was playing by the rules. But part of the problem here is that Facebook has broken people's trust multiple times. Look at Cambridge Analytica, look at the Russian election interference concerns and all of that. And I think what's happening is that you're seeing this blowback continue to happen, not only in the public sphere where people like you and me are talking about it, but also in the government sphere. You know, the United States government has been woefully behind other governments, including especially Europe, in actually looking at how to regulate the tech industry. And I think this is an effort, really, to push it forward. And you have to remember who Gavin Newsom is. He was the first mayor in the United States to start offering gay weddings. And that became, it started a trend, right?
Right,
that started
right.
in 2004. And so he has a history of kickstarting ideas like this.
There's no answer to the question because we don't know what the bill is yet, but it's not like, you know, Facebook users are going to be getting a check for 3 cents every month for their information, right? Or I don't know where the monetary transaction will come from here.
Well, let's look at it this way. Facebook, in the 3 months that ended December 31st of 2018, notched almost $7 billion in profit. There are 7 billion people on the planet. So what I think it could be a potential future here is that some value that you create for Facebook is shared with you. And I don't know how that would show up, right? But I think the point that Gavin Newsom is making is that merely giving you free access to the service is no longer enough. if they're not going to follow the rules and continue to hold our trust. Because right now it feels like the companies aren't really being held accountable for what they've done. And I think this is his effort to maybe push it in that direction.
We'll see what happens. I mean, I have a whiff of a tax coming on for Facebook and others that would then go to state government that would, you know, they would try to distribute in some equal way or something. I don't know. But it, certainly groundbreaking there, and we'll see what happens. They tried it in Washington State, didn't they? And they came up short?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of states have kind of threatened these types of things, and they never get very far with it.
Right.
And look, I mean, Gavin Newsom got shot down when he started in 2004. So, you know, at one point, he's probably not going to get very far, but he's starting a conversation. And for that, I think it's interesting.
All right. So there was this really weird article, I shouldn't laugh, in Verge.com, that the content screeners for Facebook were so stressed out that they're having sex in the hallways. Now,
I don't know, that's the fallacious part.
Yeah, I don't quite know how that triggers, but they did a story on the people who were paid, I think, about $25,000 to go through what we post and to try to eliminate hate speech, right? And the purpose of the article was that Facebook isn't doing enough to look out for their mental health.
Right. So there's actually an ongoing conversation about these people who have to look at really the worst parts of humanity. And we're talking about violence, death, exploitation of children all the time. Right. And most of us, when we see that, we cringe and we look away. They have to look at it. And I actually had a friend who worked for YouTube who did this.
Really?
And he had to go through years of therapy afterward because of the emotional toll it has. And what this story does is it looks at one organization in particular that's in Arizona that Facebook pays to do this. And one of the things that was really interesting is that not only does this have these emotional effects that cause people to act out in weird ways like hallways or doing drugs while at work and all these other things, but also they were saying that these awful things were starting to infect some of these people's minds. One of the people said that they now believe the Earth was flat, which is an ongoing thing that's happening on YouTube. And then another one said that they no longer believe that 9/11 was caused by terrorism. And these are people who are, you know, whose job it is to actually police the platform, to follow rules, to make sure hate speech and harassment don't happen. And this stuff is actually infecting their minds. And that was a really fascinating part of the story and what Facebook has since promised that they're going to try and do better about.
Now, tell me then, without being too personal, but you have firsthand knowledge of this. So your friend was a screener for YouTube, and it had an impact on him.
Oh, yes. And part what he talks about every time this stuff comes up is he talks about all the awful stuff he had to see and how regular it was. You know, I liken it in my head to whenever you talk to a doctor and you say, how often did you see people, you know, die on your shift?
Right.
And the answer is always much more than you think. And that's what it is with this stuff, is that it's really amazing how awful everything is that's flowing through Facebook and YouTube. And look, to their credit, these are the people who get flagged and find it and take it down. But they need serious mental health help to be looking at this stuff, just like a policeman who goes through an awful shooting needs to be seen by therapy, just like anyone who's a torture victim has to be through therapy. These people are constantly being exposed to awful things. And part of the point that this story by The Verge made was that they need to be treated the same way. They need to be treated with the same kind of respect and thought as people who go through other sorts of traumatic
events.
It's
fascinating because, you know, you used to think, well, it was all automated and Facebook could do it by machine. And the argument was, no, we need human eyes. They've hired a lot more human eyes to go through this stuff. And they're doing it looks like, at a real cost. Well, read more about that. There's a take on Facebook's response and more at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you this week. I appreciate it. I hope to do it again next week.
Absolutely. Take care.
It's 12:21. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG. And Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Bill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And one of the things we're always talking about, and we were just talking off the air about, is how important it is to have a retirement plan, right? To have a path and a means to get to retirement and then to get through retirement.
Yeah, a really good, honest-to-God plan. And Steve, if you're in your late 50s to early 60s, I can't say this strong enough. It's really time to take control of your future. You need to understand just how much risk you have. You need to understand if you have enough money to retire without running out. You need to understand how much income you need.
Now, if you're in your 50s and 60s, don't most people already have a pretty good idea?
Well, that's the problem. They believe they have a plan.
Right.
But we come to find out that they really don't. I'll give you a couple examples. This is within the last week.
Okay.
We had a couple come in that had some old variable annuities. They've had them for over 20 years. They thought everything was going fine.
Explain for me what a variable annuity
is. A variable annuity is an annuity full of mutual funds, basically.
Okay.
Okay. And they were using this for 20-some years, and they thought things were going well. With one phone call, we found out over the last 22 years that they've paid over $400,000 in fees.
What?
Over $400,000. And they thought they were doing okay. We had another couple this week.
Go ahead. Was this on their statement, or did they
no,
see?
No, that's the problem. It's not on the statement. So these folks had no clue how much fees they were paying.
Okay.
And as soon as we see a variable annuity, we immediately call the company. I've been doing this for 35 years. I know the right questions to
ask. Right, right.
So we do that, and we found that out.
So they paid $400,000.
Over $400,000.
What would someone typically pay?
Yeah, maybe 10% of that.
Okay.
Maybe 10% of that. And it was a big name variable annuity. I'm not going to mention the name because I don't want to be sued by the folks, but it was a big name company.
I'm sitting right by you. I don't want to be sued either.
No, we don't either. We had another couple come in this week also, and they brought in a variable annuity, and we made our phone call, and we found out that it had an excellent, excellent guaranteed income for the rest of their life. For the rest of their lives. The problem was, it was only for the rest of the husband's life.
So if the husband died first,
the wife does not get that.
Money's gone.
The money's gone. There's no guarantee the wife doesn't get it.
So in both of those cases, I would imagine those people went into your office thinking that they were in a good position.
They thought they were okay. And part of the problem, Steve, is, you know, I shouldn't have to be an expert in brain surgery. I shouldn't have to be an expert in a lot of different stuff. You shouldn't. Our clients shouldn't have to be experts in retirement planning.
Right.
And the problem is, they in a lot of cases, they don't even know the right questions to ask. And that's the advantage of getting a second opinion and really understanding where you're at.
Well, if I'm getting statements from my investment company, my annuity company, I see my balance, but I don't see my
fees
being taken away.
You don't see the fees. You don't understand how the guaranteed income works. You bought it. You thought everything was great.
Right. And so that's the value of just, I mean, you mentioned a doctor earlier. It's the value of getting almost a regular checkup.
Getting a second opinion.
A second opinion, yeah.
So what to see if things are going right.
So what do you do when someone comes in your office and the doctors have bedside manner? How do you tell someone that they've paid $400,000 in fees?
Well, actually, we had it on the speakerphone.
Okay.
And because if I told them that, they'd say you're nuts.
Right.
But this was the representative from the company just answering my questions. And you have to know the right questions to ask.
Right.
If they called up, they wouldn't have gotten that.
And so, right. So, again, I talk about doing things online myself with calculators and things like that. It's an interesting idea that I wouldn't know that some annuities like this have fees, exorbitant fees. I wouldn't know how to find out.
No, you wouldn't even know to ask the question necessarily.
Right.
Because it's not in the forefront of your mind. It's not what you do.
So your point is that even if you think you are in a good situation, find someone to give you another look, another view of it all to see where you are.
Right, right. And along that line, you know, we normally do a complimentary plan for people with $500,000 and up in their portfolio.
Right.
We've been having a lot of people call into the office with smaller portfolios wanting to know whether we could help them. Today, we're going to do something really special. If folks have $250,000 or up, they can call the phone number, They can get a complimentary financial plan, and we will take care of them. We'll make sure that they're set up correctly.
So you're going to do this for $250,000?
For $250,000 today. $250,000 and up.
Bill Geiger, nice to see you again. Thanks for coming by.
Good to see you, sir.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, are you confident that you're doing everything you can, everything you should be doing to prepare for retirement? Bill Geiger and his team at Geiger Wealth Management are going to help you answer those questions. They have a special opportunity for you today. And as you just said, Bill said, they're going to change their regular plan. They'll sit down with you personally to create a full-blown financial plan for your retirement. It's up to a $3,000 value, and it's complimentary for the first five callers who have at least $250,000 saved for retirement. So call 800-681-2498. That's 800-681-2498. At this stage of your life, you probably have more money than you've ever had before, and the last thing you need is a big loss. Together with you, Bill and his team are going to translate the complex financial planning process into easy-to-understand steps with a personalized, full-blown retirement plan. It's designed to help you retire with confidence. Call Geiger Wealth right now for your complimentary, personalized, full-blown retirement plan, 800-681-2498. Let me give you that number one more time. It's 800-681-2498. Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, and we thank them for that. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, and we follow the bouncing home values. I don't know, they've been increasing. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, and I'm going to put you on the spot just because you asked me not to.
No, gee, thanks, Steve.
So, you know, we're going through an election process here. What impact would, and I don't really care about either one of the main candidates so much as, but what impact will this race, could this race have on Chicago real estate? What's the importance there?
Well, just last night, Lori Lightfoot tweeted that the Lincoln Yard should be slowed down. She tweeted, what she tweeted is, don't build the Cop Academy on the West Side that a lot of people have been opposed to. Wait and let the new council and mayor decide.
Right.
But she said, like Lincoln Yards, which of course is a massive real estate development on the North Side, or potential real estate development on the North Side, she said that one too was rushed through.
Which it was.
So that's one sign, I think, of what might happen.
And from my point of view, it's maybe not such a bad thing that it was rushed through, because, you know, the people who had the power to get it done are getting it done.
The other thing that could happen is this could change the discussion of rent control. I mean, just, you know, I see everything through a real estate lens, because Tony Preckwinkle is in favor of lifting the state's ban on rent control. And Lori Lightfoot, what she has said is, I'm not opposed to lifting the ban, but I think there are other solutions, like building a lot more affordable housing.
That was on the ballot in a few neighborhoods again Tuesday, wasn't it?
Tuesday. It was the smallest piece of the city where people have voted so far. There have been three elections where the rent control thing has been on the ballot. But again, like in the first two, overwhelming support. More than 60 in many precincts, over 70% support for lifting the ban on rent control.
And the reason to support the lifting of the ban on rent control is people being priced out of their apartments?
Yes, though some people just put it down as local control, because again, if you lift the ban, that doesn't create rent control. All it does is make possible the creation of rent control.
Okay.
So a lot of people see it as
well,
more like
but
a,
if you want the ban lifted, you want rent
control. You probably want rent control. Yeah, so yes, the reason to support it would be that a lot of people believe that rents are rising so fast that people are being priced out of their homes.
And this is a neighborhood situation, not so much a downtown thing. I mean,
yeah.
We got a glut here, right?
Right. Well, downtown there.
The landlords, justifiably, their hair catches on fire every time they hear the phrase.
They do.
Because they invest in property to charge rent.
Right. What the real estate industry says is if you create rent control, you are going to stall investment in the properties, because the landlords know there's this cap. There's just no way for me to maximize my profit with a lot of new repairs. This rent control legislation that we talked about that is not related to the referendum, but would create seven districts in the state for rent control, that has provisions in it for allowing landlords. It's trying to make it work for landlords as well as for tenants. The question would be what we actually create down the line if we create a rent control
program. So, and I'm sorry, you just were talking about the state bill?
Right.
Okay. And Governor Pritzker has weighed in on this in one way or another?
I don't know Pritzker's stance on the rent control situation.
Okay. Before the headlines, I was talking about how we were going to kick around this house that is now only $50 million. And I love this story.
I know you do.
I just love this story. This guy built a $65 million house on Burling, right? Mm-hmm. In the Lincoln Park neighborhood?
Just south of Hermitage, okay. Like just south of Lincoln Park High School.
All those really big houses.
This was really the first one. This was the first before Cindy Pritzker and several other people, sports team owners and others, all started building big mansions. This really was the one that got that ball rolling.
The last line in Dennis's story is, a motor court is lined with imported French gravel.
I'm sorry, you're reading the story about your house.
Oh, yeah, no, that's mine is crumbling asphalt.
Oh, there
actually,
we go.
Yeah. No, so, but the guy, he built the $65 million, that's a beautiful, stately house.
Yeah.
And did he tell you, or he just kind of admits, he goes, I know, the cost got away from me, but my wife was really into it.
He said that to somebody at Crane's before I worked at Crane's. Okay. But I had spoken to him for Chicago Magazine previously. Yeah, so apparently they spent $65 million building this thing. They've had it on the market for a couple of years. It was off the market for a recent few months and came back last week at $45 million. Markdown, that's a big markdown. First of all, it's 10%, but it's also at $5 million just in dollar terms. You know, that's a markdown that could buy you several houses.
Right. But even with that markdown, it's twice as expensive as any other house in the city?
It's still, yeah. The next highest listing is over by the Newberry Library in the $21 million range.
While we're talking about expensive houses and condos, tell me about this $8 million condo in the Ritz-Carlton.
You know, that's an interesting one. I think we talked, I can't remember whether it was you and I, but I know I talked about it on WGN. There was this battle over the top floor.
Oh, we did talk about this.
We did talk about it. Peter Francis Geraci, the bankruptcy attorney, was involved because somebody mysteriously had dibs on that property. Well, in the course of time, reporting and lawsuits, I determined that it was this Mexican billionaire. I'm not even going to try to use his name because I'll mangle it, but Larea is the one word that most people use as a surname for him. He had dibs on a higher level unit. He paid about 3.7 for this unit we're talking about, which is not the one he had dibs on. Not sure why he did, although there were reports that he had a daughter living here in Chicago. And now, several years later, he's got it finished as living space and on the market at $8 million.
So when the Geracis were in court fighting to buy this property, they were fighting this copper baron from
Mexico. Fighting this copper baron, yeah, who's the second wealthiest man in Mexico. And one thing I was interested to find, he's a billionaire. He's richer than any of Chicago. He's a part-timer, or his daughter is in Chicago. He's richer than any Chicago billionaire, including Governor Pritzker, including Ken Griffin and others. He's super wealthy and has this $8 million condo off Michigan Avenue.
We were just talking, Kelly Leonard was in earlier this week, and he's got a podcast with one of the founders of Ritz-Carlton, or one of the refounders, Horst. I've lost his last name, but anyway, so I didn't realize there was just this sort of property inside the Ritz as well.
Well, this is the Ritz-Carlton Residences. There's the Ritz-Carlton, which is a pretty prominent property. The Ritz-Carlton Residences was built at Erie in Michigan, right at the tail end of the last boom.
Okay. So $8 million.
Yeah.
You want to go halvesies and we can each keep our suburban place and then come in every other week? You want to do it?
Yeah, that'll work real well. I've got my $4 million in my pocket today.
Oh, well, that's good. Then you can put down the down payment. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Sometimes the best business decisions are simple things that go together. So Columbus-based DSW isn't overthinking it. The Discount Shoe Warehouse will offer shoes and start offering pedicures and manicures to customers. It's your one-stop foot shop. The CEO, Roger Rollins, is saying that they wanted to develop and differentiate experiences to ultimately retain and attract customers. They say that manicures and pedicures will start at $30 and $49, but you're going to want to save your pennies if you want to eat at a few of the restaurants nominated for James Beard Awards. Unfortunately, no Chicago spot made the coveted Best New Restaurant category, but we were well represented in a number of other categories like Best Chef in the Great Lakes Region, Outstanding Baker, Rising Chef of the Year Under 30, Outstanding Restaurateur, and others. There's still some time before the final event of the year on May 6th at the Civic Opera House, so you can check out the spots for yourself. Just go to jamesbeard.org and look at all the semifinalists. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute. Hey!
Hey! Thanks very much, Ori and Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. You can read his stories at chicagobusiness.com. He writes about real estate and... Okay, so I don't know where to go. If we should start with Resurrection Mary or just the Wilmot or the Willowbrook Ballroom. Because the Willowbrook Ballroom was this, you know, historic venue, right?
Yeah.
That all I knew from it was in its last days was, I think it was Channel 7 or someone would do the New Year's Eve broadcast.
There'd
be someone at the Willowbrook Ballroom. And like, what is this about? But in its heyday, Duke Ellington, all you know, they had all the big acts.
Everybody was there. Yeah. So it's the thing that kills me is that it was originally going to be a summer home down there. And then the son of the owner says, you know, ballrooms are getting, let's create a dance floor. And then it just builds and builds and builds.
It started as an outdoor dance floor.
Started as an outdoor dance floor just because my son wants to dance, that sort of thing. That's in the early 20s, but it lasted 95 years until 2016. The list I saw had Count Basie, the Buckinghams, the Village People, Ozzie Nelson, everybody playing there over the course of time. Then in 2006, it burned down.
I'm sorry,
2016. Yeah. You're right. It burned down. And there was an attempt, there was a foundation that was going to try to rebuild it. That didn't happen. And it is just now selling. One piece sold. It's a 12-acre site. Just now selling to a residential developer.
So who was Resurrection Mary seeing when she was killed on the way home?
I don't know who was playing there, but she appears to have danced her last dance at the Resurrection.
Famous Chicago ghost story.
Yeah, it's a great one. She's the famous hitchhiking ghost of Archer Avenue. Supposedly, she's buried at Resurrection Cemetery, but nobody is quite sure which of the Marys buried at Resurrection she is. And the story, so what's funny about it is, so apparently...
If her name was Josephina, it'd be easier to track down.
Exactly. Yeah. She's hitchhiking. This ghost hitchhikes on Archer Avenue. And what I seem to have determined with the things I've read is the story didn't initially include her coming from the Willowbrook Ballroom, but over time that has been the Resurrection Cemetery is one end, and the other end of her route on Archer Avenue became the Willowbrook Ballroom. But it's a great story that she's dancing with a guy and she gets jilted, and she in the 1920s she storms out of the place and she's hitchhiking on Archer Avenue, which would have been of course a much more rural road at that time, and she's hit by a car and killed, and supposedly her ghost still hitchhikes back and forth between Resurrection Cemetery and the Willowbrook Ballroom.
Well, if you're in Willowbrook, and especially in city government, that's sort of the ghost of the ballroom has been haunting them, right? And now, finally, there's going to be a big development there?
Yeah, over 200 homes, condos and townhouses. They're going to do some sort of memorial to the Willowbrook Ballroom, but this is the first big real estate development in Willow. I'm sorry, we've been saying Willowbrook. The ballroom is named Willowbrook. The town it's in is in Willow Springs.
Okay.
Should be more clear. This is the biggest development in Willow Springs in decades.
Just because they haven't had land to develop, really.
Yeah, exactly. This is a 12-acre parcel. And it's got a great view. You know, it's got thousands of acres of forest preserves. Those Palos forest preserves down there are beautiful. And you've got the I&M Canal, and it's a pretty cool site.
And they're moving quite along, right? Because they think that people could be moving in this year, even later this year, next year?
That's their goal, yeah. This is a builder who is very experienced and believes that now that he's got things rolling, he can actually have people moving in this year.
All right, and but nothing, no, there will be no haunted condos or haunted, right?
I asked the developer, so you're not afraid of ghosts? And he just completely flat said, no, I'm not afraid of, you know, that was it.
Right.
Let it roll off him.
You got to figure out a way to market that somehow.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, let's go to Lake Forest. Marcus Lemonis bought his neighbor's house.
Yeah, in October.
In October.
late September. I reported in early October. We probably talked about it in here.
And now he wants to sell it at a 35% increase?
Just a few months later. Yeah.
If he does, right, that will show why he's a successful businessman with TV shows and all that stuff.
Yeah, your sentence started with if
he
for
does,
a reason.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the property? What's going on there?
It's really nice. It's just above Lake Forest's big, beautiful beach on Spruce Lane. And he... It was on the market for quite a while. He bought it at a huge discount. As far as I can tell, he replaced the roof, re-tuck pointed the chimneys, and put it back on the market.
Okay.
About a 35% markup. So I don't know what's going on. He won't respond to emails. His real estate agent said she couldn't comment. So I don't know what's going on, but it seems like a pretty quick... an attempt to flip something pretty quickly.
So he paid 1.85, and he's selling it for 2.5.
Yeah. Or asking 2.5. It seems likely it would go for 1.85 again.
And he tuck pointed the chimneys.
Yeah.
Put on a new roof.
Yeah. Okay. So 1.86.
So we'll see how that goes for him. But it's not on his property.
It's not quite next door. His property and it create an L. They
okay.
share a piece of a boundary.
Okay. Well, we'll follow that. Chicago home sales and the home sales in the area, as I understand it, we've got less than a minute here, but we continue to chug steadily along.
Yeah.
So we're not dropping maybe like the rest of the country, but we're still below the rest of the country.
Yeah. Not home sales, but price increases, specifically the
You're so polite when you correct me.
Well, the Case-Shiller Index shows. So it's been very interesting to watch because I'm always reporting we're at the bottom of the index. We're at the bottom of the index. Our prices aren't growing like everybody else. But what's happened more recently is we have a string of months where our prices have been growing at about 3% year over year, which is a nice, healthy clip.
Mm-hmm.
Nationally, prices were growing at 6.5%, and they've shrunk to growing about 4.5% year over year. So we're still growing at a slower pace, but we're not crumbling. We've been steadily moving along, growing at a very slow and steady pace.
Dennis Rodkins from Crane Chicago Business. Read more at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.